All right, I'd like to start. Can you guys just wave if you can hear me? Wave. Oh, great. Look at that. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit about the festivities tonight. So what we're going to do is that I'm going to talk about detecting and weathering nuclear and radiological terrorism. Then Dr. Ellen Raber is going to talk about cleanup for particularly chemical and biological WMD. And then Professor Kiesling is going to talk about the engineered biothreat. So I'm going to just get started. So I'm going to talk about detecting radiological dispersion devices, and that's RDDs. So I talk about RDDs, that's what that is, and nuclear weapons. And then I'm going to talk about what their effects are. And you heard a little bit about this last week, but really when I start talking about this detecting these devices, my goal is to describe for you the general plan that's being put forward by the Domestic Nuclear Detection Office that's a part of the Department of Homeland Security. And actually, it's an office that was just formed this year. And really at the instigation of the out of the Vice President's office, and based on a concern that really one of the worst scenarios for WMD and Homeland Security is the nuclear weapons scenario, and so that's part of the strategy to have our country prepared for that. So what is our general approach? And you heard Rick Norman talk about it in lectures past. You heard Rick Norman talk about this concept of how to protect the ports and what we're doing in the ports. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to tell you about sort of like the overall plan, like what's our big plan on how we're going to protect the United States against nuclear and radiological terrorism. So the big plan is a layered defense-in-depth approach, and that's what pretty much most people in the business believe is required to counter nuclear terrorism. And so a layered defense means eliminating or protecting excess stocks of nuclear materials and weapons, detecting and interdicting the illegal movement of nuclear and radiological material overseas, then screening incoming cargo and conveyances for nuclear and radiological materials, enhancing domestic detection and interdiction efforts, and then implementing an effective nuclear forensics and attribution program. So I'm just going to repeat this because this is sort of like the key to the national strategy. The idea is I've got to play with this. This technology is so cool. So the idea is, again, first to keep the material safe overseas and domestically and also, but overseas in particular. Catch it en route. Screen anything incoming. Just in case you don't get it when it's going through the borders, catch it in transit in the United States. And if you're able to catch this material or intercept these terrorist networks beforehand, have an effective forensics program. Okay, I'm trying a new color now. I have an effective nuclear forensics program to figure out, where did this material come from and what, and to be able to unthread the terrorist organization that would, that would have been a part of it.
Can I ask a really general question?
What's that?
I just have a really general question. Is there any reason to believe that this is any better than the other parts of DHS, or is it just a bunch of memo writers and strategic thinkers with no actual execution ability?
Well, that's a good question, and it's a hard question. I am working with, and Ellen can comment on this too, and she talks. So DHS is composed of a lot of strategic thinkers. I wish there were more economists in DHS. I think that, one of our goals as part of the National Lab is to inject science into this equation. They have made several billion dollars of investment in the general area. But it is a good question. Are they ultimately going to be successful? I don't know. I hope so. I sure hope so as a citizen, taxpayer. But it's a big challenge. It's a really big challenge. It's a science challenge, too.
Good question. I have another question.
Yeah.
Are there other motivations for movement, illicit movement of nuclear materials than terrorism that we're aware of?
So maybe, like, give me an example of what that would be.
Like, I'm a small nation, I want nuclear power, I don't want to pay for it at market rates.
That's a good question. My guess is, my guess is that even now the potential retribution why would it be bad for a state to do that? Well, I think they just look at Libya, for example. I mean, you just take a look at Libya and say, you know, the Libyans didn't believe that it was really in their interest to do this kind of work so other countries can look at the Libyan experience and how the United States dealt with them, how they dealt with the United States, how they made the decision making. And so I'm just thinking that that provides some idea that there's some deterrence there. And I think there actually is quite some deterrence there. You know, if you wanted to use nuclear power, the best way to do it is go through the IAEA, because the IAEA has been supporting and promoting nuclear power for, you know, quite some time. So I'm guessing not.
Well, maybe a better example would be medical uses of radiological materials versus potential non-medical, i.e. terrorist uses.
So would you smuggle just to get the medical? I mean, I'm thinking that I think that the downside of smuggling and the trouble you get from the first world nations is pretty much a deterrence. I mean, I think
they catch you.
They catch you. But you know, that's what I'm kind of thinking. But I am certainly not an expert in that area, but I'm thinking that there's quite a bit of deterrence there. And there's not that big of an upside for medical isotopes. I mean, you know, we're talking about third world countries and the needs of the third world country. And so I'm thinking that, you know, a lot of medical isotopes have a lot bigger upside for the first world than they do for the third world. Okay, so I'm going to just talk about the global defense architecture. And so the idea is that you need a global architecture to have an effective deterrence. And so that starts out with this, you know, this materials protection, control, and accountability program that's been going for some time. And the idea of that is to secure the material at the, you know, where it's made or where it's being kept, and particularly with particular emphasis on our former Soviet Union. And then work on proliferation detection. And then make sure that we're aware as best as possible about, you know, who the proliferant countries are and what their activities are. That's part of the Proliferation Security Initiative. Look at foreign borders and ports, and that's an example of that is the Megaports Initiative. Look at container security. Then once you get to sea, look at container security. And then you get to the United States, and that one is really... You know, and so then when you're talking about the United States, you're talking about the major ports of entry, the borders, you know, the sea borders, the land borders. What we don't have in here is the air. You know, as we know, that's a very important mode of delivery. And then once they get in, you know, what are the highway routes? And then once you look at the highway routes, you know, how would you, if you had evidence that there was that there was nuclear radiological weapon or materials in a city, how would you make the network? You have to make a network to try to find that. And so all those things are trying to be talked about in this DNDO office. And there's been quite a bit of work going on, quite a bit of technical work going on to see whether, you know, how successful that can be. So the other thing is that success is more than just detection. So you got to encounter the adversary, detect the threat, identify or classify the threat, and interdict it. And so and all this has to happen with some kind of sustainable operational burden. And so you say, well, you know, it's kind of frustrating to watch DHS because you say, man, you know, they're not moving very fast, but it's a pretty big, you know, it's a pretty big problem. You know, the other thing that I would say, though, is that this might not, I don't know if this is the best place to bring it up. Maybe I'll bring it up after this slide. is that, okay, so there are a lot of recurring themes. A lot of people are thinking about this and working on it. There are a lot of recurring themes. First of all, the security of special nuclear materials. Those are materials that can be used for a nuclear weapon that can get a nuclear yield. That's critical. No single detection initiative is has a good enough performance to assure that successful detection and interdiction is possible. So what this is saying is basically there's no silver bullet. Very, very important. Then radiation signatures are only one factor that contributes to successful detection and interdiction. Does anybody, I don't know if anybody's heard of this, of the Bulgarian case of highly, the interdiction of highly enriched uranium. So let me just tell you about that. Actually, there are two very good examples of cases of successfully either catching the movement of nuclear materials or an example of terrorist deterrence that involve no radiation detection at all. And I think actually these two simple cases that are examples to us. It's very interesting that they don't each actually involve radiation detection signatures, and even though I'm going to talk about radiation detection signatures. So what are they? The Bulgarian sample. So some years ago, there was a fellow in a car that was passing through the Bulgarian border, and he was stopped by the Bulgarian border patrol fellow, and he seemed nervous. And so the border patrol guard asked him some questions, and he immediately produced tens of thousands of dollars in cash, in U.S. dollars. And to his credit, the Bulgarian guard didn't accept that money, and in fact took the guy in. And what they found was in the car, hidden in an air compressor, hidden and shielded by a lead shield, was a small vial of highly enriched uranium. With a little packing slip that was written in Cyrillic. So you say, so there they did. They interdicted highly enriched uranium. Did they use any radiation detection signature? No. It was done by good police work, good guardsmanship. So I think that's a very important point, is that when we think about the technology it takes to avoid nuclear and radiological terrorism, is the importance of good police work and good law enforcement can't be underestimated. Here's another example that's pretty interesting. Yeah?
What was the weapons value of the quantity of enriched uranium detected? One, and two, is there some background on this guy? I mean, I think he's pretty unprofessional.
He was pretty unprofessional. You're right. I mean, it's pretty interesting that they would send such a fellow. Now, the amount of highly enriched uranium was very small. In fact, you can get the report on this on the internet. And you wonder, well, why would you be sending this little vial of highly enriched uranium? Some people speculate that it might have been like a sale sample. That's one thing, and that's just true that the person that was carrying it was certainly, he wasn't the owner of the sample, and he was a person that was transporting it, and he wasn't the best professional. I think that gives us a good clue. Another thing that's kind of interesting is when the Chechen rebels took over the theater in Moscow. One of the things after it was all over and they were interrogating the Chechen rebels. The Chechens were talking. They were talking about the possibilities of what they were going to. They were going to attack. They were, talking about the targeting. And one of the possibilities was to. And it was a. Something they thought a lot about was to attack the reactor laboratory in Moscow, and the Kurchatov Institute. And that would appear to cause quite a bit of trouble. And so they said, well, why didn't you do that? And the reason why they said they didn't do that is because as part of this. As part of this MPCNA program, there was a lot of detector. There's a lot of construction in the Kurchatov Institute. And when the terrorists looked at that, they said, there's risk there. We're not sure whether we can be successful. They were more sure that they could be successful with the with what they did, which is take over the theater. And I think that this is a very important point for what the heck are we trying to do when we say we're trying to avoid nuclear and radiological terrorism? It isn't so that what we're trying to do is to stop every terrorist that tries to do something. What we're really trying to do is to try to make it so terrorists don't choose to do nuclear radiological terrorism. So what does that mean? That means we're trying to increase the uncertainty of whether they can be successful. You know, we're trying to understand the metrics of what the terrorist is using for targeting or mode of action, and make it so that nuclear and radiological vectors just don't seem like they would be very, you know, that's not the, that, those aren't the things of choice. And so that's our real goal. Okay, so I'm going to get back to this. So, again, radiation signatures are only one factor contributing to successful detection and interdiction. Active interrogation, I'll talk a little bit about that, can provide an effective means for detection of shielded materials and shielding. And that's something that Rick Norman talked to you about earlier in this class. The response concept of operations is critical, and that's a big challenge right now. You know, there's a lot of technology being put on the table, but the question is, you know, what are you going to do if you have a positive signal? How are you going to handle the positive signals? And then, you know, the performance of the current radiation detection technology is pretty limited. And that's something that if we want to have this national infrastructure, something we really have to work on. Okay. So there are a lot of different kinds of delivery vectors. There's air, you know, you can see them here. That's an issue. And the magnitude of the border screening effort is enormous. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, we're talking about to monitor the whole thing. We have hundreds of thousands of vehicles, thousands of trucks, thousands of aircrafts, hundreds of aircraft, hundreds of sea vessels that need to be, you know, that need to be checked every year.
Can I interrupt again?
Yeah.
So I just checked the web on that Bulgarian sample.
Yeah.
And there are two interesting things that it says. One is that Lawrence Livermore was able to do forensics on the sample and identify enough characteristics that they would have been able to match it with enriched uranium from the same source. Okay, that is the forensics are advanced enough that they could actually get a signature out of this that would have let them match it with another sample. But the other thing they point out is that when the smuggler was brought to court, the question the judge asked was, what was the value of the apprehended uranium? And the answer was $3,000 to $4,000. So the judge fined the smuggler $2,000 and let him go.
But you know, the key there is not catching this one little smuggler. It's the information that we get from that. So knowing that, okay, this individual, you know, is someone involved. This is an individual that now we can go out from, you know, and understand who does this individual interact with. You know, because the whole key there is that it's not catching that guy or, you know, punishing that guy for having this little vial of highly enriched uranium. The key is finding out who he's working with. You know, who's
right, but it seems like for $2,000 they let him go. So
Yeah, well, there you go. That's what happens when you smuggle a little bit of uranium in Bulgaria. So the U.S. Coast Guard patrols a lot of miles of U.S. coastline. The Border Patrol is responsible for a lot of miles of land and border and a lot of miles of waterway. So you can kind of see, though, that this is a huge problem. If you look at, like, the national perspective, it's actually a huge challenge to try to protect us from this movement of nuclear radiological materials. So DHS is deploying and developing radiation detection technologies in a lot of venues. One is to enhance border security, and that's completing the deployment of today's technology at legal points of entry. And that includes passive gamma neutron detection and radiography, developing and deploying the next generation of passive and active detection technologies. Tell you a little bit about that. You heard a little bit about that earlier. In a previous lecture, develop the defense architectures within our border. And this is what, you know, people get a lot of press, or, you know, DHS gets a lot of press over, because, you know, frankly, it is really important to understand the system. And then develop and integrate the new technologies to improve system effectiveness. Okay, so radiation portal monitors and radiography are being deployed right now at our points of entry. And so, you know, Customs Border Protection is deploying portals and radiography systems at mail and express consignment courier facilities, land and rail crossings. You can see some of that here. You can see some of the land crossings here. Seaports, international airports. But a lot of technical challenges remain. And so one is the primary screening sensitivity is often limited by the capacity to resolve nuisance alarms. So nuisance alarms are people that are radioactive because of medical procedures. They could be ceramic tiles. that are radioactive because just because of naturally occurring, you know, radioactivity within the tiles. Coleman lanterns that actually look a lot like really kind of frightening sources. So, you know, that the nuisance alarms is a big deal. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then shielding limits the ability to detect certain threat materials. So radiography can be employed to detect the presence of shielding materials because they look, you know, dark on radiograph. And then active interrogation can be employed to detect, to look at special nuclear materials directly. So with active interrogation, you're creating the signature. With passive detection, you're looking at the gamma rays or the neutrons that are coming out. Active, you create the gamma rays. You create the neutrons. Or you create that signature. Okay, so radiological screening thresholds are limited by this alarm rate and not by the sensitivity of the technology, and that's really important. So a key thing is to be able to figure out what's alarming the system but is not actually a threat, and then what ones of those alarms actually are a threat. And this just gives an example of the signals probability distributions versus in terms of counts per second. And so you look at the the background, that's the one in blue. So you can kind of see this background. The vehicles, which is our norm rate, you know, that's this dashed red line. So the question is, where do you put your threshold? What you want to have is you want to have a threshold that's so high. I mean, this would be kind of like an ideal situation. You want to be able to put your threshold up here, so you really don't get any of these norms, and yet you'd see your threat. But the reality is that too often, your threshold is down here where you're seeing a lot of these, you know, again, naturally occurring radioactive materials. You're below, or you're above the background, but you're not. But you're getting fooled by the naturally occurring radioactive materials. That's the big issue. Okay, so again, these norms or naturally occurring radioactive materials drive the secondary inspection rate in two levels. So this long tail of the norms, and I don't see, this is hard to see. I'll make sure this gets fixed on your view graphs. But the point here is that you really can't see the, there's no data on this. But I'll just tell you that if you look at, you know, it's not the background that drives the problem. It's the naturally occurring radioactive sources that drive your problem. And that's, so what's key is being able to sort out what's important and knows of what's not. Okay, so just to give you an idea of, you know, what are these norms? They're kitty litter, very important. Medical isotopes. So the biggest problem is kitty litter. Go figure. Then you've got your abrasives, mica, granite slabs. That's a big problem. Toilet bowls and tile, and cars and trucks. So medical treatments account for significant alarms. Some of you saw the talk by Don Prosnitz, and he talked about the issues of privacy and working through that part. And then again, you there's many normal things that are normally moved around in commerce. And so that's the real key, to be able to figure out what's important here and what's not. Okay, spectroscopic portals will provide the next generation of performance and passive screening. So what does that mean? That means that we're using the energy spectra of the gamma rays coming out to help figure out what's important, you know, what's really dangerous and what's not dangerous in these radioactive materials. And then you got your handheld identifiers. Here are a bunch of examples. Just to tell you this, you know, this one is this particular one is from Livermore, and the neat thing about this guy is that it has very high energy resolution. So that's something that's used, kind of expensive. It's kind of like on the order of $100,000. So it's hard to have a lot of those. But it's good for resolving the kind of alarms that come up when you don't have very good energy resolution. Intrusive inspection involves, you know, this is when you can get close in, and it involves portal systems. You can have relocatable systems. Talk about working on rail and then mobile systems. Another issue is figuring out, you know, how to catch things in transit. And to do that, they're looking at different screening opportunities that are, you know, they're evaluating different screening opportunities. And this is just a map of the of the frequency of travel from source points to destinations, from common source points to common destinations. Okay, so the grand challenge in the research that people are working on is figuring out how to detect shielded special nuclear materials, and then distributed sensing, long dwell in transit, standoff detection, you know, looking at alternative signatures for radiological materials. You know, an example of an alternative signature is the fact that you know, shielding is heavy, and these, you know, high density, high atomic number materials are, well, they're heavy. So that's something that's an example of a signature. A lot of other signatures. Another thing is that material is not spread out in, you know, like if you take like a rail car with nuclear material, it's likely the nuclear material wouldn't be all spread out evenly. It would more likely be, you know, in one place or a few places. So that would be another example of, you know, it's not exactly a radiation signature, but it's very important spatial signature. Better detector materials. Well, why do you want that? The reason why you need better detector materials is really about cost, because you're talking about, you know, deploying these detectors nationwide or even worldwide. Then detector materials become a very important issue, because that's the cost of your whole system. Another thing is that if you're talking about worldwide deployment, systems have to be really simple, because, you know, we're talking about, you know, a wide variety of capabilities, wide variety of you know, in terms of available power, in terms of available staff, and just sort of like the complexity of, or inability to deal with complexity of technology when you move from the third world to the first world, and want to, like, if you want to look at, you know, have something in all major ports around the world. Okay, so different kinds of passive technology. We're looking into imaging. Well, why is imaging important? It's because imaging is particularly important for search, because because the background radiation rate changes with position and time. And so if you have a source that's located at some distance, like 50, 100 meters, so if you have a point source, if you're just driving by that point source, it's hard to tell the difference between that point source and just a slowly varying background. But if you have an imager, then that point source shows up as like what it is, which is a point source. So that's one of the main reasons for imaging. So and actually imaging, you can prove that it increases fundamentally the signal to noise ratio over the over a non-imaging capability, and there are various flavors of that. Of course, always looking for ways to, in all of this as well, looking for ways to figure out what's the difference between naturally occurring radioactive materials that are not dangerous and then ones that are threat materials. And a lot of that's involved in spatial distribution, big energy distribution component, figuring out how to get this beautiful energy resolution that you see here. This is counts in the detector versus the gamma ray energy. Try to get this beautiful energy resolution in a room temperature material that's very robust and low power and easy to deploy all over the world. A big, big topic. Probably, I would say, one of the most important topics. Then looking at active interrogation initiatives. So there's gamma interrogation, neutron interrogation, and then there are these advanced ideas about, like, for example, how to use the time correlation of the neutron and gamma signatures that come out of an object to recognize when you have a multiplying system of special nuclear materials. So it's like really the dangerous system. Okay, so in all this, I would say that, you know, clarity is sort of king here. Here's some good examples of why this isn't such an easy problem. Operational environments are kind of challenging. There's some problems here. There's plenty of room to work in. There's a lot of office space. This fellow, by the way, this guy is a physicist. This poor guy that's standing out here in the cold all day long is a physicist who's trying to make sure the detector's working. That's not an optimal situation.
So this is the detector at a border, is that what it is?
Yeah, well, that's actually, it's at a stop. Yeah, it's a detector at a border, yes. Things bump into other things. The weather's great. And the public is fully cooperative. These are some of the challenges that we face in trying to in trying to develop a system that protects us against this terrorist use of nuclear radiological weapons. So I want to move on to, so what if we fail? You heard just such a beautiful lecture last week, I thought, on the sort of this general topic. So I want to just visit a couple things on this, and then Ellen's going to talk. Okay. So what are kind of like the baseline consequences? The baseline consequences is that our RDD, and you heard this last week in a very beautiful description of why, is not a lot of deaths in RDD, not a lot of injuries, certainly not a lot of these consequences on the RDD are driven by explosive problems. Nuclear weapon, real bad. We'll talk about that. Okay, so let's talk about radiological dispersion devices. The dirty bomb, or radiological dispersion device, is conventional explosives, generally conventional explosives combined with radioactive material with the intention of spreading radioactive material. It's not a nuclear explosion, very few deaths, particularly from radiological exposures. But the contamination will hamper emergency response. It's going to cause problems, and it's an economic issue, really. It's economic and a fear issue, economic driven by fear. And widespread contamination can deny use to facilities and can change the value of property dramatically. Okay, so what are these sources? Here are just kind of like the big sources. They're the big ones. These are the Killikuri sources, which is like the fuel assemblies, the spent fuel packages in transit. There are the radiation generators. So these are like heat generators. And then there are the medical sources. And so as you can see, your real big sources here are actually these giant sources are generally pretty hard to get, with a stunning exception, some people believe, of the strontium 90 generators in the former Soviet Union. And
question.
So, what's that?
Could I ask a question? In the upper right, what is a SR-90 RTG? That thing with the Air Force.
So this is actually okay. So this is actually an as it says U.S. Air Force here. So I'm going to go on a limb and say it's from the Air Force. but it's actually a it's enough strontium 90 so that you have, it's a little power generator that's actually driven by the fact that you have a lot of radioactive material. And in the Soviet Union, they used these for beacons, and they used these for primarily for power sources, for beacons, for part of how they figured out just navigation on land and at sea. And so the big issue for this is not so much the U.S. Air Force ones, but the real question is, how about those ones in the former Soviet Union? There's a lot of effort to try to find those. Some of them are like stuck in ice packs. There are like strewn around the cold areas of the former Soviet Union. So I would say that's sort of a big topic of discussion. Okay, so we're talking about an external exposure of radiation. So whole body exposure can result from like a passing radioactive cloud or smoke, or a large distant point source, or exposure from contamination that's deposited on the ground. And focused radiation or localized contamination can result in a radiation effect to specific areas of the body. And that's like an inhalation, or it could be from a close point source, but it could be like inhalation, ingestion, embedded radioactive material. So those are kind of like two different kinds of injury. Okay,
I have a question. Would it be within the scope of this work to consider for instance, medical radioisotopes in water supply or something like that?
In our supply?
So medical radioisotopes exposed through water supply, food supply.
Oh, yes. But you know what, though? If you look at the exposed to the water supply, that's a pretty tough one, because the water, dilution is really great. So it's pretty, I'm just saying that, water, that's a, dilution works pretty well for that. But food supply is another topic, and there are some publications in the last year that have looked at that and with some pretty grim some grim conclusions. Oh, but also that those are some pretty.
So I guess I would not represent. Really, my question is: DHS concerned about more than people blowing things up?
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Other vectors for the dispersal of radiological substances.
Absolutely. So those vectors include explosive release, non-explosive release, like an aerosolization of another, other kinds. These are just examples of things people talk about. In place source. So like hiding a source in one of the tables here, and then announcing it a month later, or maybe not announcing it and waiting for people come in with radiation injury, and then contamination. So those are all vectors that people look at and work on.
There's an accounting issue here that this word kilocuries relates to the Rankine exposure mass to a bunch of accounting packages.
That's right.
So that the total quantity of REMS that Professor Muller talked about last time is tied in some way to this kilocuries thing. I don't know if you want to go through that or to clarify it, but there's a sense in which those... That slide says the total REMs that you can deliver, if I'm right, but usually I'm not. Can you comment on that?
Well, yeah. So actually, you can. I mean, people spend an awful lot of time trying to figure out, based on this number of kill curies, or however curies, how much, how many REMs could really be delivered to the lungs, or how many REMs could really be delivered to the digestive system, and that's different for different isotopes, and it has to do with, especially for like this kind of ingested scenario. It depends on how effective the dispersal is, and it's also dependent on physiology. So it's pretty complicated to make that conversion, but it's certainly something, a big topic of work. So in internal exposures, what's important, how do you do that conversion from REMS, which is kind of like the thing that you care about, from kilocuries to REMS, which you care about. So, it's how much material is deposited, how to get into the body, is it different modes of how got in make a big difference in how serious the exposure is. What's the chemical form of the radioactive material? I mean, I think that was mentioned last week that just on the how to get into the body, plutonium by ingestion, not a big deal. I mean, you could eat it pretty well. Inhaling, not a good idea. So what kind of radiation it produces, how quickly it decays, and how quickly the body eliminates the material. But when we talk about internal exposure, and this is important, when we talk about internal exposures, we do it by summing the dose that will be received over the next 50 years into one time interval of deposition. And I hope to be able to talk about this at the end of, when I come back at the end of the evening. But that's just fundamentally different biologically than talking about a burst exposure or one time exposure and immediate exposure. So, and that's very important because what's important in radiation is time, dose, and fractionation, and so that's just important when we talk about doses. And we can't use internal doses to predict acute exposure effects like nausea and vomiting, and that's important too. So these simple ways we have to figure out whether somebody's been exposed to radiation really don't work with internal exposure.
Okay. The three factors, could you repeat this?
Yeah, time, dose, and fractionation. So I'll write that down for you. I love this pen. Time, dose, and fractionation. Those are the key things about radiation. Okay, so then there's the human factor. Concerns about radiation and contamination often produce an exaggerated emotional response. And actually, Steve is going to talk about that. Later tonight or in another lecture. And the possible results can be that unexposed people that are can saturate the medical community. And with many with the same signs and symptoms as exposed people. And health effects and economic effects can have long-term anxiety and depression in the community. Okay. So what's the conclusion? The high activity sources can cause health effects, but only in close proximity. Acute health effects from distributed radioactive materials are unlikely without prolonged high concentration exposures. You really have to try to get high exposures with RDD. You know, radiation or contamination will hinder response efforts. That's certainly true. And denial of facilities in areas will have a major cost effect, including denial of facilities in areas like, for example, denial of the effects of the on the emergency room that was used to accept the patients. That's an issue of conversation right now. It's a very important issue because amounts of radiation that are dangerous to patients right now are way different, orders of magnitude higher than amounts of radiation that you could detect with a Geiger counter. So you can imagine, like, a hospital that received these patients, you know, long time planning on the isotope. You know, years later, people would come in there with Geiger counters and say, wow, you can tell radiation around, radioactivity around, you bet. So that's a major issue, major social issue. Okay, here's some references, and you can take a look at those. Okay, now I'm going to talk about nuclear weapons. That's a completely different story. Again, you heard last week that there are sort of the three flavors of nuclear weapons. There's the kilotons, the tens of kilotons, and then the megaton weapon. And just to compare,
Before you go forward, can I back you up for just a sec?
Yeah.
It seems to me that, you know, you had that chart in the beginning where you showed the five different possible interdictions. You know, you look here, you look there, you look at the borders.
Yeah.
People must have tried to be quantitative about this. That is, to associate probability to our ability to do those things and assess some kind of likelihood.
Yeah, actually, there has been a lot of work done on that. In the last couple of years.
And what's the answer? For example, I mean, we look at less than 10% of the containers that come into the country, for example, and there are a whole bunch of foreign countries that we have essentially no access to, and a whole bunch of those detection devices you showed us were more like somebody's theoretical idea of what might work rather than something that was deployed. So when you crank all this through, you know, if someone actually wanted to launch an attack like this, then there's a whole other question, is what's the probability of somebody trying? But assume that somebody tried, what's the probability that we would thwart it?
You know what, I think you kind of answered your question.
So
I mean, I'm not trying to be terrible, but it is. You know, it's incredibly challenging. I mean, it's incredibly challenging. If you think about it.
Sure,
it really is.
I buy that. So then the question is, there must be a 90-10 rule. That is, some point at which, if your goal is to do the best you can for a reasonable amount of money, rather than fund the energy labs or something like that, where do you stop?
Yeah. So that's a very good question, and in fact that's probably the number one question that DNDO is trying to answer right now. And they're answering that Congress has asked them to answer that before they get their big plus up in, you know, as they get their big plus up in funding. You know, and I think that's the big question. Everyone, exactly how you do that is, I don't think that's an answered question. If it was super answered, it would be part of the congressional record. I mean honestly, you know, I mean, it's, you know.
And how much of the work is a sort of a science and technology effort going forward, and how much of it is a deployment effort?
Well, the big bucks, of course, are completely deployment. It's completely. But I'll give you an example of where science and technology could fit in sensibly and maybe not. So new detector materials. So if you wanted to, a new detector, you know, history tells us that it takes about $100 million to develop a new detector. Or, you know, a new detector material, really, you know, to its full development where it's actually useful and not by a bunch of, like, pointy-head physicists like me. You know? But, you know, so the question, don't laugh, I know you're a biologist. Okay, we had snickering from the biology crowd in the Berkeley area. But anyway, so the question then is, you know, so what, you know, when is that a benefit? When is that investment a benefit? Well, you know, we're talking about, you know, being able to, you know, billions of dollar investment to try to, you know, if you think about trying to outfit the world or outfit the United States with radiation detectors with any kind of sensitivity or frequency that you could really, you know, you could really have this robust system. So, I mean, I'm just saying, like, that's an example of where, I mean, I think that there's a lever there, and because, you know, we're talking, you know, if you can make a detector that costs 10 times less, or that's even deployable in this kind of worldwide environment, I mean, that would be huge. That would be an example of, but not in the stuff with a zillion wires and all that stuff. I mean, I think that's very much more limited. Yeah.
So you alluded before to a problem where the level of radiation that we can detect is much lower than the level of radiation that's harmful. And I think what you're getting at is that people start to freak out at a fairly low level of radiation. Emergency crews don't want to go in there. People don't want to use that real estate. All those kinds of things. Potentially something that needs to happen is we adjust our expectations of how we respond to radiation.
You bet.
What kind of work's being done on that?
I wish there was being a lot more work being done on that. You know, there's actually a group of sort of social psychologists and psychologists, you know, sort of wanting to work on the general problem. But I would say that it's woefully, my personal opinion is that's woefully underestimated. Really an important problem. But the United States generally is totally focused on prevention. And that's different than Canada, by the way. Canada is focused on response and recovery. But really, it's a different point of view. The United States, we're all about prevention, you know, really, for the 90%, more than 90%. Okay, I'm going to, like, quickly move on here because, so, okay, nuclear terrorism is real bad. Here are things that, so, you know, I mean, I just wanted to put some things out here that, you know, nuclear is not so different than RDDs in the sense of radiation is still not the primary hazard. As bad as radiation is for nuclear terrorism, still not the primary hazard. The big issue here still is blast and thermal effects. And, you know, me as a kind of a radiation person, I hate to see this stuff. But the point is that it is really important that we're really, these are the big issues. And they're, you know, like, this is like the bomb stuff. It's like a really bad, it's a really big bomb. That's first and most importantly. Okay, 50% of the energy goes out or is part of the blast, and the blast has a very special effect on human beings in that it causes a crushing effect that is really unique to nuclear weapons, and that causes eardrum rupture and lung damage, and I'll show you how far that goes out in an example coming up. So this is an example of, you know, these are big blasts. These are big overpressure waves that come out. Really, you know, that's a really unique, you know, just bomb effect. Here's just to give you, I don't know how many people have been to the mall at Washington D.C. But if you've been there, you kind of get a sense of like how big a weapon is. Because you know, some people think of like all weapons are like, you know, like these giant megaton devices, and that's not so. So I'm going to talk about a 1 kiloton device, pretty simple, that could be like something that, you know, it's like more doable. Okay, so here's Mall, Washington Monument, Capitol, Lincoln Memorial, White House, stuff that we want to keep. So if you look at the blast energy is going, so you're getting eardrum rupture, even with this little weapon, you know, out close to the, if you had the blast, you know, this is again centered at the Washington Monument, you're getting eardrum rupture out to the almost to the White House. This is, again, this is a small weapon, real small weapon.
What's the physical size?
Oh, you know, this would be something pretty small. I mean, you know, not like, you're not talking about like giant.
A suitcase?
I could picture something like that. Okay, so then if you look at the overpressure, you're getting penetrating wounds, again, a little bit farther out. Thermal is another really important one. This is a lady that was injured as part of the, you know, in the atomic blast in Japan, one of the atomic blasts in Japan. You can see the dramatic effect of thermal injury. Very serious. And that thermal injury, you're going to get third-degree burns at 7 calories per square centimeter. You're getting burn effects with 2 calories per centimeter, you know, pretty far out. Almost to the White House, you're getting serious burns. Here's one that people maybe not think about so much. Now we're stepping way back. You're at Annapolis, Gaithersburg, and Dulles Airport, so if you kind of picture where you are in the... You know, visual effects is going to be kind of a problem for responding because a lot of people are going to have flash blindness. You know, talking about way out here and retinal burns. So that's just a little bit adds to the confusion of it. and then fallout. Okay, so
is that, if I'm at Dulles Airport and I look at it, you're saying I'm going to have those?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So I mean, that's, and really, it adds to confusion. You know, well, tell you nothing about it. It's not good to be, you know, blind. So fallout is so the fallout has, there are three factors that affect fallout, and you heard about this last week, so I'm going to be fast. Particle size, altitude, and wind. You can read about this. Fallout path can extend pretty far. So we're talking about, now we're talking about, you know, 300 miles, 200 miles from ground zero, you're having a rad per hour. That's not a dangerous amount of radiation, but it is an amount of radiation that's going to cause problems for cleanup. It's going to be an issue for cleanup. But way back down in here, 4 miles away, those are serious, you know, those are sort of some pretty serious doses. And by the way, and it takes time. This is why it's so important to have a good plan for how to evacuate cities. Extremely important. So deaths from radiation injury can be dramatically reduced by evacuating, sheltering, and providing good medical care. And where you're really going to make the savings in lives is really in this fallout area, because that's where, you know, that's where people have this kind of injury that isn't stuff sticking out of them and crazy, you know, bomb stuff. But it's really about, it's just about the radiation. So if you're protected from radiation, that's great. Now, the best way to protect is evacuate, shelter.
So do we have a meteorology response to an incident like this where we need to really understand air movement?
Yeah, we do. In fact, there's a national capability called the IMAC, which actually has that exact job. And in fact, they work with cities right now, that and chemical and bio things too. Okay, fallout rule of thumb. Here's another thing that's kind of interesting. If you just wait 2 days after the blast, the exposure factor will be down by 100. So that's why they only had these fallout shelters. This is why, because the exposure goes down by a factor of 100 in 2 days. Very important.
I have another really dumb question.
Yeah.
We clearly don't have an urban evacuation capability, right?
Yeah, problem.
And furthermore, we can't invent one because the road capacity is just insufficient.
So you'd think that people would be interested in sheltering, huh? No, it's a huge, this is a very serious topic, and actually right now our government is really focused on prevention, and probably rightly so, but this is something that's going to, if this is something that's important. We saw with Katrina how hard it is to evacuate, and this is a public planning thing that's just going to be really important over the next 10 years, I think.
So you're recommending bomb shelters?
I'm saying that we need to work through for individual cities what the plan is. And the plan has to include something like shelters and something like evacuations. And I think it's pretty obvious that it's not possible to totally evacuate all the time. Or, you know, so, right. I mean, so, yeah. Here's just, you know, if you can't evacuate, a big building will take your dose down by, okay, a little building will take, if you're just inside a normal house, you reduce your dose by 50%. You're going to go down to, you'll get rid of 95% of the dose by being in the basement of a two-story house. And in a big building, you can pretty much dramatically reduce the dose, less than 10%. Okay. Decontamination's important? Yeah.
Why does your dose go down so much if you're in a higher building?
It's just distance. It's really distance and shielding. It's just the construction of the big buildings that helps with shielding, and just the size of it. It's really that.
But it doesn't matter what story you're on.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's distance and shielding. So it just depends, and you can kind of calculate through for individual buildings. And then, in my opinion, that's something that should be done. Say, you know, where should you stand? Well, kind of like in the middle, as far away as you can from the side. Yeah.
So is that assuming an atmospheric blast that would go off over the city and then go down? Or
so this is for fallout. So it's so thinking about how fallout goes down, and mostly the fallout's giving you the dose when it's on the ground and it's radiating out, and that's the stuff part that's giving you the dose. This is kind of a neat picture where they're sweeping off guys as decontamination. Ellen's going to give you a much better decontamination talk. Okay, and just to say that there a great source of information on this is the Armed Forces Radiobiology Research Institute. They've got a great website, and you can get just really good information there. And so I'm going to, at this time, just turn it over to Ellen Raber. And she is the department head for the Environmental Protection Department at Livermore, and her area of expertise, where she's been a researcher for 15 years, is in environmental cleanup, decontamination and cleanup, especially in chemical and bio. So she's going to try to switch.
Great, thanks.
Okay. Like, there's a host like this.